Good morning and welcome to Through the Opera Glass here on WBAI New York. I'm Mark Leosa, and today we have a very, very special guest. I see him as a Renaissance man, Eric Salzman. Welcome to WBAI.
Pleasure to be here.
What brings you to the station besides the number 2 train is the New Music Theater, Seeing the Voice, Hearing the Body, a new book by Eric Salzman and Thomas Tezzi. Before the theme was over, you were mentioning your radio work. Refamiliarize our listeners with your background.
Well, I have a whole background in public broadcasting, mostly radio, a little bit of television. I started out at a radio station called WBAI in, believe it or not, 1962, when I became music director for the first time. I was there 62, 63. Then there was one of BAI's semi-annual palace revolutions, and I left. And I came back in 68, actually, when I was actually starting to be very active on the New York scene, not only as a composer, but also doing non-traditional performance events. I guess we would call them performance art or something of that sort. I was very interested in connecting my music and contemporary music in general with the very lively art scene that was growing up in New York, fueled also by the social and political events that were taking place at the time. So it was a pretty exciting time, late 60s, early 70s. And I started the Free Music Store at WBAI, which lasted for quite a while. It outlasted me because I was at BAI until 72, this in my second stint, and the Free Music Store kind of stayed on for a while afterwards.
Please enlighten the listeners. What was the Free Music Store?
Well, the Free Music Store started out actually in the public theater in a rehearsal hall called Martinson Hall. Frank Millspaugh, the then station manager of BAI, invited me to come back to BAI to try to do more live music. And in fact, I instituted a policy of almost all live music. We stopped playing recordings and tried to do everything live. And the Free Music Store was the keystone of that because we were either broadcasting live or we were live taping, as we used to call it, and that is recording so that we had a backlog eventually of music. And part of the idea was that we had all kinds of music. We had everything from Archie Shepp to Renaissance music to electronic music to Eddie Palmieri and Tito Puente to all kinds of stuff. It's a little more common now to see that kind of mix, but believe me, at that time it didn't happen. You didn't get avant-garde jazz and Latin music and all that stuff mixed up in the same place, and they were completely segmented audiences. So I think we did our part in breaking down those walls, and I'm quite proud of that. The Free Music Store also, starting in Martinson Hall, but afterwards in the so-called Peace Church on 4th Street, near Washington Square. Actually, Washington Square Church, I think, is the
is
official
that Judson?
Name of it.
No, not Judson. Not Judson, okay.
Not Judson. It's the church near 6th Avenue, even though it's called Washington Square Church. And it was famous for its draft counseling in those Vietnam days. And anyway, that's what we moved it there. And then eventually, BAI, for a while, had its own church. It was an old, defrocked church, but had no money to build studios for a long time. So we had the sort of run of this whole, you know, this old church, and we put the concerts there. And at that point, we were doing stuff every single night. I don't know how long we went, for a year or 2 years or whatever it was. We were going every single night with an incredible variety of harpsichord recitals and vocal ensembles and even dance. Don't ask me how you broadcast dance, but we did it, whatever it was.
Was it tap dance, maybe?
No, it was all kinds of dance. One, we did a piece called The Peloponnesian War, which I did the music for with Archie Shepp. It was a one-man show by Daniel Nagrin, and it was a big anti-war piece, which could be packed into a couple of suitcases and traveled around. So it had a currency for that moment. And the score itself was vivid enough so that we could broadcast the score. You couldn't see it, but you could come down. And that was the beauty of BAI and the Free Music Store, was that we had instant feedback. You'd broadcast stuff, and people would arrive for the second half, having heard the first half on the radio.
And you also had a pay-as-you-exit policy or something, make a donation?
Yeah, what happened was we had no seats. Everybody sat on the floor. which was also a sort of innovation, which was later copied by other people. And we had big jugs, big water jugs by the door to put money into. And in order to prevent, I don't know if I should say this out loud at BAI, but in order to prevent the receipts from disappearing into the endless deficits of running a nonprofit radio station, we set up our own little bank account. And thus we had a little bit of money. We never paid performers except expenses. We needed certainly to pay expenses, especially for down and out artists and jazz musicians who had to transport drums and basses and all that sort of stuff. So we did have expenses, and that was paid for. So the series really paid for itself and produced a very big number of live performance tapes and introduced a lot of music and musicians to a larger, younger audience. It was quite exciting. I'd say the biggest thing probably that came out of that was the ragtime revival, the rediscovery of Scott Joplin, and literally the discovery that that there was still musicians. For example, UB Blake was alive and well and living in Brooklyn, and we actually managed to entice him down to come and play in our ragtime concerts. That was very exciting. And then, of course, he became something of a celebrity in his last years.
And BAI has that in its archive? Or Pacifica?
You know, I can't tell you what happened to the archives. Okay. I think a lot of stuff went out west and might still exist in the West Coast, at Pacifica and the West Coast. I'm not sure what happened. I saved a few things in my own personal library. They're sitting on old big tape reels and probably should be rescued before they disintegrate entirely. But anyway.
What was the feeling among the staff? Pardon listeners who are tuning in for Through the Opera Glass. We're talking with Eric Salzman, former music director and co-author of the New Music Theater. What was the mood of the staff? Were they very supportive of this revolutionary concept, a free music store?
Well, of course, a good part of the staff was very political. And there were always arguments and debates and all-night meetings and who knows what about the directions that things should be going in and what we should be doing. At one point, I told the direction of the station that they should start putting out ragtime records on albums and selling them. That would be a tremendous source of income, because it was very clear that ragtime was going to be as big again as it had been, early in the 20th century. And of course, the answer was, we're not a capitalist record company. But anyway, so that never happened, and none such picked it up with Josh Rifkin and other people. By the way, Bill Balcom, who's become subsequently a major American composer and also opera composer, was one of the stars of the Free Music Store and the Ragtime Revival. It was amazing to find the composers, some quite avant-garde, who had a secret ragtime passion and who played or even wrote ragtimes. Bill was one. Even more remarkable was Jim Tenney, who you never would have expected to be a ragtime addict, but he was.
My jaw is on the console.
Well, things were a little more, what can I say, the segments of musical taste were very divided in those days. And classical music was divided up into little compartments, and you had people who were serialists, and you had people who couldn't stand modern music, and you had this people who only believed in, agitprop songs or something. I mean, there was this whole thing, and we were just determined to break down all those walls. And I think we started something, and that Free Music Store was pretty exciting. People still come up to me in the street and say, "Aren't you Eric Salzman? Didn't you do the Free Music Store?" So while I, first of all, like to be remembered for my own music and my own contributions to what I call the developing art of music theater, as set forth in the book and in my own works, certainly these activities were part of it. It's not enough just to sit in your studio and write the stuff. You got to also get out there, and that was my philosophy.
And how did the Quag Group come about?
Well, around that time, I was working on, I had done two or three rather large-scale performance pieces. One of them was called The Nude Paper Sermon. It was actually written for an actor and a Renaissance ensemble, and it came about originally as a commission from Nonesuch Records. In fact, it was the second commission. The first one was Mort Sobotnik's Silver Apples of the Moon. The second one was the Newspaper Sermon. And the actor was Stacy Keach, not as well known then as he is now. And the Renaissance Ensemble was Nonesuch own ensemble, directed by Joshua Rifkin, subsequently became very famous as a Bach scholar, but also another ragtime addict, and played ragtime and so on. Anyway, so that piece, which was done first of all as a recording, but then later also, we did it in an 8-track studio, and believe me, 8-track seemed like an incredible thing to have in those days, a multi-track, and one of the first classical contemporary works to be put together in a multi-track studio, although that technique was becoming well-known in popular music. So the piece was created as a kind of a multi-layer theatrical experience in sound, in audio. But then we also did a live theatrical version of it, and we performed it touring and on several number of times. And that ensemble became, although there was a countertenor named Bill Zukov, who's still around, runs the Western Wind, and for whom I just wrote a piece, and a few other people who became well-known subsequently, a drummer, percussionist, composer named Dave Van Tegum, who some of you will know, and there were other interesting people, accordionist Bill Schimmel, William Schimmel, who was like maybe the premier contemporary music accordionist around, or one of the one or two, and other interesting people were, and these people came together, and we decided to form an ensemble in the spirit of that period. It was called Quag Music Theater, and it did a lot of work, some of it from written music, but a lot of it improvisationally, in order to develop the idea of what might happen and how a new music theater might develop in its own right. And that was basically the origin of that group, which stayed together for 10 or 12 years after that.
That's very long.
Yeah.
Was the sermon delivered nude? Can't see when you're listening to the vinyl, but when it was performed live, can you set up the context?
Okay, the context of that piece is that the actor's part is that of a preacher, a politician, a broadcaster, all the different types of people that use words to manipulate. And that character, who goes on a trajectory throughout the piece, he's dressed on stage, but he has different costumes. And at the end, he drops the last one, which is like a preacher's robe, and he walks off the stage nude. So yes, at the very end, we fulfill the prophecy. But the chorus, which plays a major part in this piece, starts out in the audience. And they're scattered all through the audience, and they laugh, and they cry, and they clap, and they sounds like they're reacting to things, though of course it's all done on cue. So eventually they all march up on the stage and sing various choral numbers and try to get the audience to join them in a big ohm and all this kind of thing. So it's a theatrical piece, but not a conventional story theatrical piece. Anyway, as I said, it was written as a recording, so I tried to do the theatrics in sound, but then it has this dramatic or theatrical or concert theatrical version of it. But after that, I started to go more into actual theater. And so that was as a result of that piece and another piece I did called Foxes and Hedgehogs. I formed a Quag Music Theater, and then we started to actually do performance activities in real theatrical spaces. And also I started a series of collaborations with my old friend Michael Saul, where we did music theater, sort of Brechtian-type music theater pieces on contemporary subjects. I did 6 collaborations with him going back to the 70s and 80s now. And then after Quag Music Theater dissolved, which was just too hard to keep up, there was no – I mean, we had grants and stuff, but mainly – we just distributed the income to the performers as we got it. But it was harder and harder for people. And eventually I ended up collaborating with a woman named Marjorie Samoff on something called the American Music Theater Festival, which was not in New York. It was in Philadelphia, although a lot of the pieces and artists came out of New York. And I did that starting actually in the early 80s and lasting until the mid-90s, that festival. That organization sort of exists, but not in the same fashion. It's now a small, like, theater, producing theater. But as a festival, it was a fairly big deal. It was like a national or even international festival. And we introduced a lot of interesting people, ranging from, Laurie Anderson and Phil Glass. And we did sort of operatic-type pieces, music theater pieces, experimental pieces, jazz pieces. Again, it had the range. But that was really very theatrical. Performance art and operatic and theater, music theater pieces in that festival.
You also worked in radio, doing radio pieces?
Well, I did, in my own creative work, I did three commissions for public radio. One was for WNYC, one was for KCRW in Santa Monica, and the third one was a little more complicated, but a couple of different stations were involved, including one in I think it was Upper New York State. That piece, which then was distributed by NPR, which had a hand in it, it's called Civilization and Its Discontents, and it won a Pre-Italia. So I'm pretty proud of that one. And I also had an Armstrong, which is another public radio award for that work.
When do you get time to do your laundry? You're a busy man.
Well, yeah.
And how did this book come about, being so busy? How did you find the time to write the new music theater?
Well, I have a very funny history with regard to opera. Since I'm on an opera program, I'm going to spill the beans.
Okay.
I consider myself, I believe it or not, I spent three summers teaching contemporary opera and music theater at the Bayreuth Festival in Germany. This was at the behest of Friedland Wagner, Richard's granddaughter, now passed away. And Friedland started a Meisterklass in a school in Bayreuth on the model of what she said her grandfather, apparently it's true, her grandfather wanted Bayreuth to be a center for young people, performers and directors and artists and so on, to study contemporary opera, not necessarily only the works of Wagner. And she was a kind of a maverick, like many members of the Wagner family. And she established this school, and she asked me, an American of all things, to come and to teach at that. In fact, I used to sit in the family box, if you could believe it or not. And Friedland used to say, well, Hitler sat there, and that was where Goering sat or something. I don't know. Anyway, the whole thing was bizarre. I even did performances of my music in Wahnfried, the widow of Wagner's son, Siegfried, Winifred, who was actually English and who was an unrepentant Nazi, I'm not kidding, but was sort of let off the hook after the war. She still lived there at that time. Now it's a museum, so the family doesn't live there anymore.
Did you feel any kind of repulsion of being in the presence of such anti-Semitism?
Well, you know, that was historical anti-Semitism, which what you have to realize is that not only Friedland, but also who hated her mother, she and her mother didn't get on at all. And it's true, I met the mother and had music performed in her presence. But basically the key figures there were her and her brother, who was the great stage director, who in effect rescued Wagner from the Nazis by eliminating all the helmets and the horses and all the old-fashioned stuff that the Nazis loved, and created a modern style of stage directing, which was quite remarkable. So in a way, this was a little bit the anti-Nazi period of by introducing me into the mix, Friedland was also making her own statement, you know, about her mother and the Nazis or whatever. I don't know. I don't want to get into psychoanalyzing here. Right. But I went with that. I was comfortable with that. And also there were very interesting people there. I had very interesting quote-unquote students. They weren't students, really. They were young professionals. Probably the best known of which was Michael Tilson Thomas, who was actually a quote-unquote student there and who was an assistant conductor in the house for a year or two. And so he was just starting his career, even almost pre-career at this point. obviously a very brilliant young man. And he later conducted a piece of mine at the in Los Angeles at Monday Evening Concerts, and then I brought him east to conduct at the concerts at some things I was doing in New York. So, but there were others there. It was an interesting period. And anyway, basically, I got the idea, I have to say, that much as in one way I loved Wagner and traditional opera, I really got the idea that one had to fight against this kind of opera. One had to go against it.
Why?
Too big, too expensive. Forget the Nazi associations. Too imposing. Too far from the roots of music theater as it had come out of popular music and out of and too removed from our current life and concerns. So that music theater had become in the Wagnerian music drama, and even to some extent in grand opera, some very specialized thing to be sung in a language that you didn't understand, and so on and so on and so on and so on. So I sort of became the anti-Wagner. Also, I was very much interested in going back to a simpler notion of how to organize music theater pieces, and also in a way to try to incorporate, besides the folk element, to open the door to the street, as you might say, but also to open the door to some of the things that were happening in the other arts at that time, and new technologies, to try to make music theater, to try to reconnect music with its roots in theater. Music has deep roots in theater, and they were being severed. They were being lost. And music had become a very abstract. Contemporary music, whatever you think of it and how much you might love it or not, had become very abstracted from life. And in some ways, classical music had become the most abstract and the most, while other things were happening in the other arts that were very exciting and very relevant and very much of the moment. And I wanted that to be true of contemporary music as well. And it seemed to me that one of the paths, one of the ways to do that was by reinvigorating the music theater connection. And that was, first of all, in my own work. Secondly, in the idea of putting on things, starting a group, starting a festival, whatever, so that you weren't just writing it for your desk drawer, but you were actually out there doing it. And so that was another aspect of it. And trying to make those connections. And what I discovered, interestingly enough, was that other people had the same idea at the same time, but sometimes without knowledge of each other. And what we had, in effect, was like a worldwide movement, some of which was very experimental, some of which was very rooted in popular music and folk music, but that different people were looking at this idea. And the abstraction of serialism was being attacked from various sides by various people. And it was quite interesting to make that discovery. And eventually, we sort of all found each other. And at that point, it occurred to me, or it was proposed to me, that I should write about it and make a book about it, almost as if it were a movement, which in effect it was.
And how does Thomas Dessy fit into this book?
Well, Thomas, good question. Thomas is a good friend. He's one of those people that was working in music theater independently in Vienna. He's Viennese. And there was a yearly meeting that was organized started in Belgium, actually, and then Holland, Belgium and Holland, which were big centers for this, in the 90s. And it was called, it started out with a long, verbose title, something like Annual Meeting of Contemporary Opera and New Music. I can't even remember. Anyway, it got shortened to NUOP. And NUOP went on for many years in different cities. Each year it met in a different city. And Thomas was at a number of these meetings, and I met him there. And he knew about that I was supposed to be writing a book for Oxford. And he kept saying, "How's the book coming?" And I'd say, "Fine, haven't written a word." Eventually he said, "You got to do this. You got to do this. Because nobody's written the book. There is nothing." So, and I just couldn't get started on it. So finally he said, "Look, if you're interested, I can help you do it. So he came on board, and he actually became a full collaborator, and I never would have been able to write it without him, especially because he really knew the European stuff. I was more familiar with the American stuff. I knew something about the European stuff. But it was a big subject, and it was not necessarily well documented. So anyway, he came on board, and we had the interesting – which a collaboration, by the way, that could never have happened before email and the internet, because it was between Vienna and New York, essentially. Occasionally, we were in the same place. There was one period of time when we were both living in Paris, so we were able to actually do a lot of work to get actually physically in the same place for a few months, which helped a lot. Anyway, eventually we did it.
Did it help that you were collaborating on a collaborative art form?
Well, that's a good question, actually. And I would say the idea of collaboration is pretty big in my life, and that I have been, I hope, a good collaborator. At least I like to think I've been a good collaborator, and that I have worked even to the point of collaborating on music, which is a little more unusual, I think, as I did with Michael Saul. And I think, yes, I think that music theater is a collaborative art form, as opera is, and I think that it did help that the book was a collaboration about a collaborative subject, yes.
We're talking with Eric Salzman, co-author of The New Music Theater here on WBAI. This is Through the Opera Glass. And yes, there'll be musical examples a little further on in the show. If you've missed any part of this interview, you can visit the archive at www.wbai.org and click on Through the Opera Glass, and you can catch up with our conversation. Now, Eric, in doing the research for this book, did you find that you were blindsided, people doing a certain form of theater that you were just totally unaware of?
Sure. Well, the range is actually pretty great in terms of some of it goes back to, you know, experimental stuff of the 60s that was being done from all the way from John Cage to the European Surrealists. Actually, the original European Surrealists were not involved with opera at all. And in fact, famously, Boulez talked about blowing up the opera houses and so on. They were very anti-theater. But theater came back into it. For one thing, there were a group of Italian composers involved in that surrealist movement that became involved with opera, notably Luigi Nono, and also Luciano Berio. And then also Maurizio Kagel, originally from Argentina, who ended up in Cologne and also at Darmstadt. So they came into it some, even in the experimental side of it, some people that were working in theater and had a major influence. And then in this country there was the development of minimalism. And also of performance art with people like Laurie Anderson, Meredith Monk. These were all people who had a very theatrical bent and who contributed a very different kind of approach. But I always found these contrasts and even differences to be stimulating, not necessarily I'm not a minimalist myself. If anything, I'm the opposite, whatever that is. But I was always interested in how, in a theatrical situation, you can often justify using those elements that grow out of the nature of the situation that you're dealing with, that you're trying to express. And the days when you had to be a purist about everything, I think, are long gone. And I think the fact that you can have experimental technology and tonal, even folk elements in the same piece is not doesn't bother anybody anymore.
How did we get here from a bunch of Italians thinking they're going to recreate Greek art form opera? Because in your book you talk about a bunch of Florentines.
Well, I did. We did reach back to the origins of opera, and we also talked about the evolution of the opera house, because we deal with subjects in the book like space and how you use space, the physicality of the body, many elements that are not often thought of with regard to opera, but in fact are very important. The audience and the seating of the audience, all those things are really interesting. So it pays sometimes to go back and look at history and to see the evolution of things. And then we also went back to the 20s when you had a small music theater movement, most notably Brecht Weill, but there were others as well, and in the 20s and 30s. And then again, it sprung up basically in the latter part of the 20th century. And that movement or that evolution is still in progress. How did that all connect? How did that all go? I think music theater is a very ancient art form. I think it's the most ancient of all the art forms. And I think opera is a specialized case of it.
What's the difference between music theater and opera?
Well, opera is the particular form that was invented, as you say, by a group of Florentine literati intellectuals around 1600 in an attempt to revive their concept of what Greek tragedy was like. And they believed that Greek tragedy was sung. To some extent, they seemed to be right. So they created an art form where everything was sung. And that particular art form, as it developed, largely originally in Italian, but later in other languages, became what we call opera. And the term opera has kind of blanketed everything else. Also, they developed a style of singing, or eventually a style of singing developed. I'm not sure that really goes that far back, because I think modern opera singing is really from the early 19th century rather than from the 17th century or 18th century. Which would sound to us more like early music singing than it would like. But the big houses of the 19th century had to be filled, and this technique of vibrato-based projection developed, and the big thrilling sound of modern opera voices began, probably not in Italy, but in France, where those big houses were open to the public, and they were selling tickets to the new middle-class public, and a couple of French singers began singing with this in this method, and people got very excited by it. It spread very quickly to Italy and also to Germany, and Wagner would have probably been impossible without that method of singing.
Well, Lully came from Florence.
That's true.
He...
And French opera was more like Monteverdi in the original Italian opera than it was like Italian opera developed afterwards. It's a curious fact that if you look at French, the form of Lully and Rameau is really the Monteverdian form, but the Italians had already abandoned it. The Italians were already doing da capo arias by the mid-18th century in opera seria. So opera seria and French opera were quite different. But French opera, you're right, French opera comes from the original Italian opera, which we associate with Monteverdi. Not only Monteverdi, there were others, but Monteverdi was the great exponent of it.
We may have some listeners who don't know what a da capo aria is. So could you give us a brief thumbnail definition?
Sure. The aria form of the 18th century was based on a very simple principle, which is basically the same principle that you find in a lot of popular song and in other forms of music, which is basically you have a theme, a section with a character, a certain kind of character. Then you have a second section which contrasts with it. And then you go back to the original melody and the original feeling of the opening. So it's like sometimes said to be ABA. Da capo simply means from the beginning in Italian. And what happened often in writing it out, you didn't bother to recopy out the music from the opening section. At the end of the B section, the middle section, you just wrote da capo, meaning going back. However, that doesn't mean it sounded exactly the same, because the return of the opening was an opportunity for the singer to show off their chops by improvising. And generally speaking, that's where the improvisation took place. In a lot of early music performances today, some singers have learned how to improvise, or else they get somebody to write out some variations for themselves. But the da capo form was very, very dominant, very strong It had its problems, largely because dramatically it doesn't take you further down the road or with difficulty. It enables you to go further down the road with something because it brings you back to where you were. So it's more for the expression of a character's inner feelings than it is for advancing a dramatic situation. And eventually composers gave it up. And the Italian composers of the 19th century in the operas that we love tended to prefer the slow-fast model, so-called cavatina cabaletta, which means you start out with a soulful, melodic section, and then you do a fast, elaborate, difficult section following it. But the end result of that is you're somewhere else than you were at the beginning, so it's a more dramatic form, in my opinion.
Do composers stick to a hard, fast rule of ABA, or do they do variations?
Well, ABA is such a natural form. You do something, and then you do something else, and you go back to what you did before. Here's an example from a piece of mine, which is certainly an ABA form. I wouldn't call it a da capo aria, but it's the place in the – it's a piece called The True Last Words of Dutch Schultz, and it's actually based on – a testimony or a transcription of an interrogation that the police made after Dutch was shot in a Newark chop house and was taken to the hospital. And this was a dying man in an advanced state of I don't know what. And they were trying to grill him to get information about the mob, the mafia of that day. And he went on in his delirious fashion. And at a certain point, he started to talk about his mother. And we took the texts. Actually, my collaborator, Valeria Vasilevsky, took the texts of the original and set them into a libretto form. And in this scene, Dutch actually remembers his mother and sees her as if she actually appears on the scene. And so I set the mob as a barbershop quartet, in effect. And Dutch is the extended voice singer, in this case, Theo Blackman. And Dutch's mother also appears in the scene at the very end. But the main part of the scene is the mob, the gangsters, singing. They start by humming, but eventually they sing, "Mama, mama, mama." And Dutch remembers seeing his mother, and he's telling the police commissioner to lay off his mother, lay off his girlfriend, I don't know, whatever. And then the mob comes back, still singing Mama Mama. So you get the ABA, and then at the very end, the mother actually appears and you hear her voice singing with Dutch. In some productions that's been done, the mother is one of the mobsters who is a countertenor. and he actually turns into the mother. But in this recording, in this production, which comes from the Netherlands, actually, the mother was sung by a mezzo. A very good mezzo named Valerie Nicolai. And
what size ensemble are we?
Oh, the ensemble that accompanies this is keyboards, violin, tuba, and percussion. That's the ensemble for Dutch. And this was recorded, and I'm not sure which there were a number of performances. There was a tour and so on. I think it's recorded in Amsterdam or one of the Dutch cities. It's a live performance.
And the name of the work is?
Okay. The True Last Words of Dutch Schultz, libretto after Dutch's own words by Valeria Vasilevsky, and the music by me, Eric Salzman.
Mama, 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 oh, mama.
That is the one that didn't let me get up. That is something that should not be spoke about. Mama, mama, won't you please let me out? Look out, Jack, for Jimmy Valentine. Look out, for he's an old pal of mine. Move on, Mick, and Mama, too. I can't another thing I am through. I am dying, I am all through. Can't do a thing without that G-note from you. Come on, Jack, the reaction's so strong. I don't know because my memory is gone. No knock to her because she didn't know. Look out, Jim, Jimmy, G, let her go. Move on, Mick, and Mama, too. I can do another thing I am through.
This sounds like it belongs on Broadway. I was expecting all kinds of body sounds and
there's some of that in the piece too, okay, but not right. This section. Yeah. Well, you know, it's the idea of the mob singing Mama Mama has always been a key to that scene.
And the title of this work?
Okay. It's The True Last Words of Dutch Schultz. Libretto by Valeria Vasilevsky after the actual words of Dutch Schultz. And the music by me, Eric Salzman.
When was this composed?
This performance took place in 1999, so it was 9 years ago. And it's been done a few times subsequently. It was done at the Symphony in New York at the Symphony Space Wall-to-Wall Opera in 2007. That was the American premiere. Actually, Victoria Bond did a concert version on her series a year earlier.
How is it different for you as the composer to hear a countertenor as opposed to a mezzo-soprano? Do you have a preference?
Well, it was originally written for the countertenor, and for various reasons that idea was chucked in the Netherlands production. But actually at Wall-to-Wall, we did it with a countertenor. So it's been done both ways. Yeah. And I don't know. The countertenor is a more radical version, I guess, so... It's not exactly body sounds, but it does create a kind of cognitive dissonance, I guess.
Oh, yes. Well, especially the harmonies. I'm saying, mama, mama. I'm saying, whoa.
Especially since we had a countertenor with a beard.
Oh.
Countertenors love to grow beards.
Well, you can do it with a bald soprano and have a real mashup,
yes, right,
as they call it.
Well, originally we had the idea that we were going to do the piece with all men on the stage playing all the parts, including the girlfriend and the mother, and that the orchestra would be all women. But that was a very theoretical idea. We never actually did that.
But I see a return to the roots of opera: small ensembles, a lot of non-uniformity, people using whatever instrumental forces they need or can get.
Well, I think that's a very astute point, and I think also in the economic times that we're now entering into, that's definitely going to be part of the scene. I personally feel that wonderful as it is to get to write a big opera and to get it performed in a big house, if you can get it performed in a big house, there are many, many obstacles in the way of new work succeeding in the opera world. And that the small-scale work in theatrical context has a far greater chance of making an impact. And one can say that before the recent development, and productions of new works, which admittedly has grown in the opera house in the last 10 years or so, but up until the end of the last century, almost all the important American works that you could call successful American operas started not in the opera house but in the theater. And I could make a long list of those, starting with the obvious ones like Porgy and Bess, Four Saints in Three Acts of Virgil Thompson, and you can go on from there. Many, many works, almost all originated in that period when the theater was actually producing more new operas than the opera houses were. And that was the 30s, mainly the 30s.
What is the real distinction?
Well, you know, there's a lot of ways to think about this. Probably the most meaningful distinction for audiences, and this is something that did not occur to me until one day I was involved, actually at the American Music Theater Festival, there was like one of these discussions after a performance with the artists and so on, and it was a piece of Phil Glass setting text by Allen Ginsberg called Hydrogen Jukebox, which we did the premiere of. And people in the audience kept referring to it as an opera. And finally, I was moderating the discussion. And finally, at some point, I said, "Why is everybody calling this an opera? It doesn't look like an opera. It doesn't sound like an opera. It's not an opera. Phil Glass has written operas, but this is not an opera." And somebody said, "Well, aren't those opera singers?" And I thought to myself, that's the difference. If a piece is sung by opera singers, then it's an opera. If it's sung by theater singers, it's not an opera. I don't know.
Oh, so in a way, it's moving of performance practice, style to a different genre.
I think that's true. I think performance practice has a lot to do with it. And I think that there are now singers who can actually sing both opera and in a popular music or in a theatrical style. The problem is we used to have a genre of theater singing, which largely consisted of high voices that were trained, but which put an emphasis on clarity of text, and there was a style of theater singers. Most of the women, for example, and the male leads in the Gershwin musicals were sopranos and tenors. And in the days before amplification, it was necessary because otherwise you couldn't be very well heard. I mean, even the baritones were baritenors. They sang at the top of their range all the time.
Or held in tenors.
Well, I'm thinking of the theater baritone, right, okay, though. There, people give you a resume, call themselves baritoners. They still do, believe it or not. It's not a category that classical people recognize. Uh-huh. But what it means is I sing a lot high above the staff. As a lot of, you know, traditional theater music requires you to. A lot of that music was written that way because it wasn't written with microphones in mind. If you go back to the early musicals and Kern and Gershwin and so on, And they had to sing high to be heard above the orchestra. So, but they learned how to sing high without making the big, gorgeous sound. They still had a nice sound, but it was a theater style of singing where the words were articulated much more significantly.
So where was the sound coming from? Not the chest, more from
more
the head?
More head voice, but there was a knowledge now to some extent lost of how to sing in head voice and still be under and still have the words understood, which was a trick because a lot of sopranos, particularly those with good training, have trouble singing English and making it comprehensible in the upper part of their range. I mean, I once was trying to get a singer in a piece of Michael Nyman, actually, when she was a British singer, trying to get her to articulate the words since they were from Oliver Sacks, and I thought it was kind of important that people understood what they were. And she said, I can't make them comprehensible. And that was the end of it. She would not even try to get the words comprehensible. Admittedly, the part was written high. And she just said, well, he wrote it high, and that's the way I sing it, and that's the way I'm going to sing it.
And she couldn't enunciate
the words? She couldn't enunciate in that register. And it's a problem. It's hard to do. But there were techniques for it, some of which seem to have been lost in the course of time. And people depend on microphones and often on transposing, or modern stuff is just written lower. For a while, I thought real sopranos were going to disappear from the theater until Andrew Lloyd Webber came along and the French Schoenberg came along with Les Mis and started to write again sort of operetta style for high voices. And then the high voices reappeared because there was work for them. But it's funny because for a while everything was going down into the low registers. And
he also wrote for the treble, the boy soprano.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So that made a resurgence.
Right. It is possible to do it, and there is such a thing as theater singing. Theater high voice singing, but it's an interesting issue because the microphone has really made other types of singing very widespread and common and normal in people's ears. And with the development of wireless mics, imperfect as they are and badly used as they are, there's this tendency to lean on the mics. And I'm not a person who's against the use of microphones. I know, for example, there are music critics that feel that, that microphones have ruined the musical and have, all sorts of problems with microphones. But if you use them correctly and if the music is conceived with them in mind, they can be very valid addition to the toolkit. But admittedly, it's made it's put an emphasis on styles of singing which are more intimate and more based on closer to the speaking voice and more based on folk traditions which originally people were performing in small rooms, really, and or at best maybe in Greek style theaters where they could be heard acoustically, and whereas the opera tradition developed with the idea of large theaters where the voice would be projected to the top balcony, sort of performing on tiptoe.
When did opera move from the chamber or the palace to the opera houses and eventually the grand opera houses?
Well, it moved pretty early because there were opera houses in Venice, public opera houses in Venice, several of them, by the mid-17th century already. But it has been said, and I think it's correct, that La Fenice in Venice, which was built around 1800, was the largest opera house in Europe when it was built. And it has about 1,000 seats and is now one of the smallest of the major opera houses. So the big move to large opera houses came in the 19th century. And the difference between the opera houses of Monteverdi's day or Handel's day or whatever is that the early opera houses were all financed by subscription from the aristocracy, or were actually patronized directly by the royal, by the court, by the local courts, and were part of the local establishment. While in the 19th century, they had to pay for themselves by ticket sales, and therefore they got bigger, and they put in the second balconies, and they went from 1,000, 1,500 seats, they went up into the 2,000 and 3,000 seat category.
But did they also have other amusements, like a gambling casino?
Italian Rialto? Yes, the Ridotto.
Ridotto.
Yes, in the early opera houses, opera houses were, especially the Italian ones, were famous for all sorts of amusements, ranging from flirting to gambling to who knows what.
dance improvisation.
Maybe.
Reinterpretation of the Kama Sutra. With the large-scale opera, what happened to chamber works? Did chamber works disappear?
Well, that's a good question. Pretty much, I think they did. And in fact, enlarging the houses and changing the style of singing kind of doomed the early operas to disappear to some extent or to a great extent, except for one or two works of Gluck and one or two works of Mozart. Nothing before 1800 was even performed in the 19th century.
Monteverdi, Perry.
No, all disappeared. No. Everything. Everything was gone. I think Don Giovanni was still performed in the 19th century. And maybe Figaro, not Così fan tutti, just those two works of Mozart, and also a couple of works of Gluck, often reorchestrated by Mahler, reorchestrated Gluck.
Oh,
other people did, also. So the Gluck was kind of drastically reinterpreted, but he was played. Interestingly enough, he was played more, I think, in the 19th century than he was in the 20th century, but. Largely because the French held on to it, I think.
I'm going to ask you to put on your composer hat. How do you feel about composers going back and, what's the German word, retouching, retchung, where the composers go back, Mahler went back and improved Mozart, improved Beethoven, saying, oh, the instruments are different now. How do you feel about that?
Well, I actually am a fan of the early instrument movement. And I like a lot of white voice, clear voice singing that has become back into popularity, and sometimes even in the opera house where countertenors. Because when I started going to the opera years ago, you never heard a countertenor in the opera house; it was unknown. Now there are countertenors who appear and do quite well, and some of those early operas, like the Handel operas, are actually performed.
Or do you think Peter Paris and Benjamin Britten help the revival of the countertenor?
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. There were a couple of British countertenors whose names will come back to me if I stop and think about it, who created the Vogue or started the Vogue. The early music movement, I think, started largely in Britain.
Noah Greenberg and America.
Well, Noah Greenberg was a good example here in this country. Yeah. But the famous... Oh, I can't think of his name. But anyway, there were a couple of very well-known countertenors that came out of... it wasn't so much Peter Peers, who was really just a tenor. But there was a couple of countertenors. And, the early instrument movement and the revival of the countertenor as a vocal type go together, I think. Mm-hmm. That's the vocal equivalent of...
Russell Oberlin. And
Russell Oberlin, very good.
Yeah.
That's an American one.
Yes.
But anyway, I think also one thing that the countertenors did was they opened the vocal field up to different kinds of singing. They widened the field. There was a period of time when opera singing, operatic voices that weren't of a certain Italianate type, or Germanic type in some cases, but mostly Italianate type, with a big sound, a vibrato support, and a certain kind of almost shouting quality was absolutely required. And like, for example, the Met auditions, nobody even got into the Met finals who didn't have that type of voice. And I think that's changed a lot. A Cecilia Bartoli, for example, to go away from the countertenors into someone else. That her I don't think she would have could have made the Met auditions years ago because her voice so didn't fit the type, even though she is actually Italian. But it didn't fit the type that they were looking for. And teachers really pushed their pupils to sing in that sort of Mario Delmonico style as being the apogee, the high point of beautiful singing. And I know when you make comments about singers and singers' voices, there's a whole coterie of people with very strong opinions, and they'll probably disagree. But that's the way I feel. I feel that the vocal field has widened enormously, even in the opera house. Tastes change over time. The idea that there are absolutes, I think, is mythology. And it's good. The idea, the concept of chamber opera, a small-scale music theater with different kind of voice, really the things go together. And that's why I think the vocal style does have a great deal to do with it. I think if you use that big operatic vocal style in a small theater for a contemporary piece of music theater or chamber opera, it doesn't work. It wouldn't. It doesn't. And the audience is it doesn't fit the physical situation as well as the nature of the work. So I think the idea of a range of vocal style, I think it's fun. I have very often done this, is to create pieces or to cast pieces where you're actually using the vocal type as part of the character that you're casting for, so that you can have different vocal styles in the same piece if the music is written in a way that accommodates that.
That's Eric Salzman, co-author of The New Music Theater here on WBAI New York. This is Through the Opera Glass. I'm Mark Leosa. Coming up at 6 a.m. is Here of a Sunday with Chris Wendt.